Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
So, you know, we don't really do this enough. We don't actually acknowledge when there's been a lot of good news, and there has been good news on potential COVID vaccines. Moderna's interim analysis of its vaccine and Pfizer's final analysis that they just announced today of their phase 3 trial showing their vaccine, both these companies showing 95% effectiveness in preventing COVID infections. So really, let's just take a second to acknowledge there is some good news on the vaccine development front, and it's kind of amazing given how fast this has all happened. But now, there's a whole new set of concerns, isn't there? So, Dr. Dillehay, I want to just start by asking you, what are you most worried about when it comes to getting a future approved COVID-19 vaccine actually to people in your state? What are the concerns or the obstacles to finally getting people getting the jabs in their arms?
Well, I think that one of our biggest concerns is communication. We're getting some information, but we need more information, and we won't have full information until the vaccines are actually authorized by the FDA and approved by the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices. We'll need to get training out for everyone that is going to be using the vaccines and make sure that our distribution plan is well coordinated and communicated to all those involved. So communication is going to be a very important aspect to getting the vaccines out.
Communication, training, distribution plan. So this is Dr. Jennifer Dillehay. She's joining us from Little Rock, Arkansas. She's medical director for immunizations for the Arkansas Department of Health. And I should say that this is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty from NPR and WBUR. And today we're really taking a look at the fact that we've had this sort of light speed, well, the government calls it Operation Warp Speed, but this very fast vaccine development process, the fastest in human history. And now that's meeting the biggest vaccine distribution challenge in human history as well. So we're trying to understand what those challenges are. So Dr. Dillehay, talk to me a little bit more about the reality on the ground in Arkansas, starting with the communication question. I mean, what specifically needs to be communicated when we get closer to actually trying to distribute a potential COVID vaccine?
Well, in preparation for the vaccine, we need the hospitals and the clinics and the pharmacies that plan to administer the vaccine to patients to enroll in the CDC COVID-19 vaccination program. So communicating the need to enroll, the information about how to enroll, and what they're committing to is an important aspect of the communication. And many of them have questions that we can't quite answer yet because we ourselves don't have full information. So it's developing those relationships that are ongoing, where ongoing communication can occur when more information is available. So it's very intensive relationship building and planning on a lot of individual entities on their part. So those are one of the initial things that we've got to get ready for, is getting the vaccinators ready.
And so, for example, when you say they'll have to be clear on what they're committing to, what do you mean by that?
Well, if a provider wants to give vaccine, then they need to have a strong commitment about how to store the vaccine, maintain the temperatures properly. And then when they administer the vaccine, they need to gather that information about who they've administered to, enter it into the state immunization information system, which is like an immunization registry. And then they have to report their doses that they've administered and track it so we can monitor the inventory. And so there will be some reporting on their part to the CDC about their doses on hand and what they've administered.
Okay. And there are so many really important details here regarding how the vaccines must be administered at that end point between the provider and the patient, for example. Because if I understand this correctly, we'll talk about cold storage in just a second, but the Pfizer vaccine, is it coming in a vial that has only a limited number of doses in it? And once you open the vial, I presume that like you can't just keep it in storage forever. I mean, there are lots of particular details that that providers will have to come up to speed on.
And that is absolutely the case. So, for instance, with the Pfizer vaccine, they have to maintain it at minus 70 degrees centigrade, either in a freezer or on dry ice. And then when they want to use the vaccine, they have to thaw it in the proper way, and they have to add some normal saline to it. And once they add the saline to a vial of vaccine, it's only good for 6 hours. So they have to use all 5 doses within 6 hours, or they have to discard it. So there are things like that they have to know how to do and be prepared to do it in a timely way.
Wow. So there is a lot of endpoint planning, just even in doctor's offices or pharmacies, that's going to have to take place just to administer the shots. That's really interesting. Now, first of all, so cold storage. In the Moderna case, it's, what, minus 4-ish degrees Fahrenheit, which is, I guess, a typical freezer might be able to achieve that. The Pfizer vaccine requires ultra cold storage. Do you have confidence that all the facilities, doctor's offices, pharmacies, et cetera, in Arkansas specifically would have access to the kinds of storage they need for these vaccines?
Well, the storage is something that really has to be paid attention to, and not all facilities will be able or willing to do that. In addition, the minimum order that can be placed for the Pfizer vaccine is 975 doses. So a place that would only want a few hundred doses would not likely want to manage so many doses of the Pfizer vaccine.
And so that means that it's not as much of a concern?
Well, we're hoping that we'll have both Pfizer and Moderna vaccine so that the places that can handle the Pfizer can get that, and the places that are smaller and cannot handle the Pfizer can get the Moderna vaccine.
I got it. So that really matters because, again, there's this – it seems to be, as everything with this pandemic – once again, the big divide between better resourced communities or hospitals versus those who have fewer resources is being laid bare. But it sounds like, given the differences in storage requirements for these vaccines, maybe that's a little less of a worry than it otherwise might have been, Dr. Dillehay?
Yeah, I think there are some differences, too. You know, once you thaw the Moderna vaccine, it may be possible to keep it in the refrigerator for several days. And that would make it easier, for example, to transport the vaccine to an outlying location where you only need to give a few doses. Mm-hmm. So there are some logistics that all have to be coordinated and worked out that's going to make the education about what's needed very important for the vaccination providers.
Yeah. Also, there's other details which are really interesting. So both vaccines need 2 doses, right, within a specified period of time. So there's going to have to be a lot of tracking done to be sure that people come back in time and get the right second dose as well.
That's exactly right. The Pfizer vaccine, the minimum interval between the first and the second doses is 21 days. And it hasn't been published yet if there is a limit to how long after 21 days a second dose would be allowed. And that's the same thing with the Moderna vaccine. So both of those are going to be an issue if they begin right away. The Moderna vaccine, the minimum interval is 28 days. So you have to track both of those separately. You have to get the second dose with the same vaccine you got the first dose with because they're not interchangeable. So that should be trackable in our state immunization registry, but people will get confused and they may not get the second dose the same place they got the first dose. So it has to be possible to verify actually which dose they got the first time.
Mm. So data tracking, timing, all of these things. Dr. Dillahaye, can we just take a step back here? Because I've got to ask you, have you ever had to manage anything like this?
Well, no. But, you know, when I came into this role, my son's very encouraging said to me, "Mom, your whole career has prepared you for this." And of course, it is true for many public health professionals. We have worked hard for many years to prepare as well as possible for something like this. So I wouldn't say I'm totally unprepared. And just because I haven't done it before doesn't mean I can't do it. But you are correct. This is a new deal. This is a new event in the history of public health. And many people are stepping up to the plate to do whatever they can to assist.
Yeah. And just because I just want to underscore, absolutely, just because people haven't done this before definitely does not mean that they can't do it. That's like a triple negative. But I completely agree with you. I'm just trying to get a sense as to like how different this is, though, than, say, you know, the administering mass flu vaccines. I mean, it sounds like mm-hmm. it's really quite different.
In some ways, there are similarities. In some ways, there are differences. And we in Arkansas, we've been practicing mass administration of vaccine every fall with flu season. But we've had to make changes. For instance, this year, you just can't line people up to get a COVID-19 vaccine because of the contagiousness of the virus. You know, you wouldn't want to vaccinate while at the same time exposing everyone. So we're going to have to shift to more drive-through and clinics that are spaced out or smaller, and the timing's going to have to be different. So people are adjusting to that.
Well, Dr. Jennifer Dillahaye is Medical Director for Immunizations for the Arkansas Department of Health, joining us from Little Rock, Arkansas. Dr. Dillahaye, thank you so very much for joining us. Arkansas is lucky to have you.
Well, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you, Meg.
We're going to talk more about vaccine distribution when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're talking about the fact that the fastest vaccine development program in human history regarding potential COVID-19 vaccines is now meeting a new challenge, the largest vaccine distribution challenge in human history. Well, I want to bring into the conversation now Dr. William Schaffner. He's joining us from Nashville, Tennessee. He's professor of preventive medicine and infectious diseases and immunization policy at Vanderbilt University. Dr. Schaffner, welcome to the show.
Hello, Meghna. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you back. Also with us from Raleigh, North Carolina, is Julie Swan, professor of industrial and systems engineering at North Carolina State University. Professor Swan, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
So let me, first of all, start by getting a little bit of reaction from both of you on what you heard Dr. Dillehay talk about regarding concerns or challenges that she sees in Arkansas regarding distributing a potential COVID-19 vaccine. She talked about everything from communicating to public health professionals across the state, the particular training that's going to be required, let alone the logistics around distribution, tracking, cold storage, even down to planning around when vials are going to be opened and mixed. I mean, it sounds like a great deal of it sounds like a logistical challenge that could tax any public health system. So Dr. Schaffner, your thoughts on that?
Well, Dr. Dillehay did it very nicely. She talked about the entire spectrum of issues. As I see it, one of the important things will be, indeed, as she said at the beginning, to communicate clearly, transparently to the general population. People want to know, is this vaccine safe? They've heard we're working so speedily to bring this vaccine to the people. Is it safe? And we're going to have to reassure them about that. And then exactly how effective is it? And for how long will the protection last? Which we won't be able to tell them. You know, this whole vaccine development program has had a political veneer. And we scientists and people in public health are going to have to try to strip away that political veneer and concentrate on the scientific public health issues. And I think the fact that the election is behind us has eased that very, very substantially.
Professor Swan, your thoughts?
So my colleague is right. Dr. Dillehay covered so many of these important issues. I've looked a lot at the distribution systems and logistics that states both used for the distribution of the H1N1 pandemic vaccine back in 2009 and what some of them are planning this time around for COVID-19. She mentioned relationships. Partnerships are certainly going to be really important as we determine the best ways to use the Pfizer vaccine to reach the population. It certainly, as she mentioned, could be sent to places that are best able to handle that based on their infrastructure and how many people they need to vaccinate to use up those minimum 975 doses efficiently so that we're, you know, covering as many people as we can with that and making sure that we're still finding ways that we can reach people who are not in big cities, perhaps through Moderna vaccine, perhaps through partnering with commercial pharmacies, and perhaps even doing some secondary distribution with the Pfizer vaccine if necessary, to ensure that people across the entire state will have access to it.
So I'm just going to repeat a question that I asked to Dr. Dillehay, because I'm really trying to get my mind around the scope of the challenge right now. So Dr. Schaffner, are the efforts that are going to have to be put forth for successful distribution and, you know, administration of a COVID-19 vaccine, have we done anything like this before? How similar is it to previous global efforts for mass vaccination, or we really are in new territory here?
Well, I guess I would analogize in the following way. Dr. Dillehay and her counterparts across the country in state immunization programs have been, in effect, mountain climbers. They've done the distribution of all kinds of different vaccines to all different providers in their states. But this mountain is higher than any other that they've ever climbed. So the challenge is very substantial, but these are very experienced people who know about vaccines, know about the providers, have a good sense of the populace and what sort of information they need. So yes, it's a large challenge, but it is one that we can succeed at. It will take time. If you want to vaccinate 330 million people in the United States alone, we can't do that in a week and a half. Mm-hmm. This is going to take months. And we'll have to communicate very, very clearly when it's your turn to get the vaccine, because there will be a prioritization scheme that is presented. Yeah. The early vaccine will go to healthcare providers who take care of patients with COVID and emergency medical technicians, people who work in nursing homes, for example. And then the second group may well be people at increased risk of severe disease, people age 65 and older, people with underlying illnesses, and then on down the road, the healthy population. But that will be in the future. We'll have to communicate in each location, in the big cities, in rural areas, when it's your turn to get in line and roll up your sleeve. And I think we can do that, but it will take a really sustained, very large effort. And as Professor Swan, I'm certainly sure, appreciates, this will be an elaborate logistical challenge that's right up her alley.
Yeah, you know, one of the silver linings to this terrible pandemic is for those people who care to learn, the work of public health officials now, like we're all trying to get educated on what public health officials have been toiling at behind the scenes for other diseases for year after year. And, you know, I'm just thinking about the level of detail that has to go into the planning, because as, you know, Dr. Dillahay said, for flu vaccine clinics, you kind of have everyone come in, sit down in the office and wait to get their jab. But of course, you can't do that with COVID. So even just planning on like the frequency with which people come in or doing it while folks are in their cars, like it's just quite remarkable, the thought that's going to go into a successful campaign to get a COVID-19 vaccine out. Now, I want to also just encourage both of you, please help us nerd out here. The technical details are actually quite important, okay? So let's move upstream a little bit here. I want to play a little of what Moderna's president, Stephen Hoge, said about their vaccine on Monday.
We have a lot of work ahead of us. Knowing the vaccine is going to be effective is great news, but we still need to complete the regulatory process, which involves completing the study and generating more data, even some follow-up and safety data. And then, of course, we need to get busy manufacturing.
So, Professor Swan, okay, the regulatory process is one thing, but getting busy manufacturing, you are the systems engineering specialist here. What are the challenges in getting busy manufacturing hundreds of millions of doses of these vaccines?
Well, that's a great question. And there are lots of challenges. One of the good things is that because everyone knew that this was really urgent, all of the companies, the pharmaceutical companies, have been already working on their production process simultaneously with the phase trials to make sure that it's safe and effective. And so that does make it easier to scale up sooner than what would normally happen when you develop a new product. And so that's why when the regulatory approval is there, after the data has been reviewed, we'll start seeing doses come out pretty quickly. One of the other things is that because of the specific technologies chosen, these mRNA platforms and some of the others that are coming next in the next vaccines, they're using different kinds of production processes than what we use for our production of influenza vaccine. Influenza vaccine is produced in chicken eggs, and it takes a while because you only get a little bit from each egg. You've got to have lots of clean eggs to produce it in. For the COVID-19 vaccines, they're being produced in bioreactors. So there are more ways that production can be scaled up.
Can I just jump in here for a second? So do we have enough reagents for those bioreactors? Do we have enough vials to store then the vaccine that's created in the bioreactors, things like that?
Oh, yeah. So this year, everybody is now thinking about supply chains. On the one hand, that's great. On the other hand, when supply chains are in the news this much, it probably means there was a problem. So certainly people have been looking at all of the different elements of the supply chain for these pharmaceutical products. It's not just the bioreactors themselves. It's also these bags that go in the bioreactors. There certainly are the glass vials that you mentioned. There are syringes and gloves and all kinds of auxiliary supplies. So we have been working on this part of it simultaneously while the pharmaceutical tests have been run. So I do anticipate that we will have enough, at least initially, and I know that capacity worldwide is being scaled up across all of these. There certainly is the potential that some component has been missed or some further disruption happens, but a lot of people have been paying attention to all of the products that are related to the production of these vaccines.
And just basic question, where will they be made?
It's a great question. So I looked at that the other day. Pfizer has two main production sites. There's one in Kalamazoo, Michigan. There's one in Europe. I believe it's in Belgium. Moderna has several. And then if you look at the upcoming vaccines, AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson could potentially be next. AstraZeneca has announced a number of partnerships with manufacturers all around the world. So these pharmaceutical companies have somewhat different models. Pfizer is probably concentrated on these main two locations, whereas AstraZeneca will be likely produced in multiple locations. I think Moderna, what we get in the U.S., will be produced in the U.S. at a couple of different sites. So that and the corresponding capacity to fill and finish the vaccines, I think of it like taking the syrup from Coca-Cola and putting it into the bottle with a label and the cap. That part of the process is also being scaled up, and they are partnering with organizations to make sure that they have enough capacity on that side as well.
So, Dr. Schaffner, we're not going to get all of these doses out overnight, right? This is going to be a process over many months. But do you have confidence that all this the scaling up is happening in the way it needs to?
I do. As Professor Swan said, a lot of people have been working on this for quite some time in anticipation that the trials will be successful and we're going to start the delivery process. So all of these details, do we have enough needles and syringes, alcohol pads, as you mentioned, glass vials, stoppers for the vials, labels to put on the vials? Can they get printed up? All of that, I think, has been worked on for some time. And, of course, we'll keep delivering the vaccine over months, really, going forward. I would anticipate that we will be vaccinating in some form or another well into the summer of 2021. You can't do this overnight. Mm-hmm. And then if we take an even larger view, of course, we'd like to vaccinate, with the help of many partners around the world, the global population. We're not the only place that this COVID virus is causing so much misery.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. So let's talk a little bit more. So that's production. I do want to talk a little bit more about actually getting the vaccines to the places that it needs to get, which is everywhere. Because I think most people, I'll raise my hand, me included, never even gave a second thought to the fact that these things had to be cold stored, let alone sometimes in ultra cold storage. So, Professor Swan, what's the technological infrastructure needed to get, say, Pfizer's vaccine to a rural hospital or rural doctor's office at -70°C?
That is a great question. And you mentioned Pfizer in particular. That is the one that has the strongest requirements on that cold chain. There are others that have lesser requirements. It would be more similar to what we have for other vaccines already in our system. For -70°C, this requires one of two things. So Pfizer is shipping it in a thermal container that will keep it at the appropriate temperature. It has to be repacked with dry pelleted ice after 5 days, and after 5 days again. And then on day 15th after production, it should go into the refrigerator, and it begins that last portion of the phase when it's available for use before it perishes. And I think that's about 5 days as well. So really, from the time that you would receive it, you have 10 to 15 days to utilize those vaccines. If you're in the part of the phase of the campaign when we're trying to vaccinate as many people as possible, anybody can come and get it, it's not limited to the population, then that might be a little bit easier because you could hold mass vaccination clinics and get everybody within some region. But in the early parts of the campaign, this is really going to be particularly hard because we'll be trying to reach these very targeted groups, such as medical workers who are caring for COVID-19 patients. And there may not be 975 of those in one location. Now, if you did have a freezer, a special freezer, it's called a sub-80 freezer, then you could store it, but you're unlikely to have that infrastructure in place in advance in rural areas. There are some states that have bought some additional sub-80 freezers. So I looked at a state plan yesterday, and they have 20 that they're going to be locating around the state. Another state has a few distribution centers they're planning on setting up. But even if they don't have sub-80 freezers or distribution centers, there are ways of using this vaccine. I've come up with three strategies. Certainly one is to send the Pfizer vaccine preferentially to large cities or where there are lots of people, and you would ask those people to drive to you. A second one is that you take the vaccine and you take it mobile. So you take it to a particular location and then you try to reach populations by taking out a certain number of vaccines and try to deliver them to the partners in the local area to use up those 975 doses.
Mm. Well, Professor Swan and Dr. Schaffner, stand by here for just a second because we do have to take a quick break. We are really trying to understand the very specific logistical challenges, communication challenges, training challenges around what would effectively be one of the largest vaccine distribution efforts in human history around a COVID-19 vaccine. So we'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunio was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we are going to be talking about Alaska's Tongass National Forest. It's one of the largest intact temperate rainforests in the world. And last month, the Trump administration decided to remove some federal protections previously that the forest enjoyed, and now about half of it's going to be opened up to development, road building, and more logging. And so we're going to be talking with Alaskans who know the forest well. And we want to hear from you if you've been to the Tongass, if you're an Alaskan, or if you have thoughts on how to strike the best balance between development in a forest, economic development, and environmental protection. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about next steps in the development of a COVID-19 vaccine. We've had good news in terms of laboratory development and clinical trials from several potential COVID-19 vaccines. So we're looking at what now will be eventually one of the largest distribution efforts for a vaccine in human history. I'm joined today by Dr. William Schaffner. He's professor of preventative medicine and infectious disease and immunization policy at Vanderbilt University. He's with us from Nashville. And Professor Julie Swan also joins us. She is in Raleigh, North Carolina. She's a professor of industrial and systems engineering at North Carolina State University. And Dr. Schaffner and Professor Swan, we've been discussing the cold chain challenges around these COVID-19 vaccines. And just to remind folks, the Moderna vaccine needs to be kept at about minus 4 degrees Fahrenheit a typical freezer could probably achieve that. The Pfizer vaccine has to be at around minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit. That is Antarctic winter cold. So we spoke with Alicia Clark. She's a pharmacist with Direct Relief, a humanitarian medical organization that's done a lot of work around the world. And we asked her, how do you pull off cold chain distribution?
We get the medication from the manufacturer directly to our licensed facility. That is then checked and inspected and placed into our inventory, where it's stored for between 2 and 8 degrees Celsius, which is monitored 24 hours at a time. There's multiple sensors. It gets adjusted as needed. Once the product is ready to go to a partner, it's picked and packed into validated shipping containers. And these shipping containers are really specific for cold chain product. It's down to every detail of how these things are packed, in what order, depending on what season it is. And then within each of those containers, there's temperature monitoring devices that we include with each shipment that take the temperature every 15 minutes. From that point, the pickup from our facility is coordinated. The delivery to the end recipient is coordinated. The recipient uploads all of the data from those temperature loggers. And if everything looks good, it's okay to dispense.
The COVID-19 vaccine needs to reach people in every possible type of environment around the world. So Clark is worried about less resourced communities.
Our concern always lies with, you know, those vulnerable patients, low resources. Is it going to reach them? And we see those challenges kind of on a daily basis when we do ship our regular cold chain products. And that's, you know, the insulin and other vaccines and some of the oncology agents. So I think that we expect the challenges to really parallel our everyday experience and our everyday challenges, and just don't really want that to be missed. We don't want, you know, people to be forgotten or slip through the cracks during this whole process, just because everything's moving so quickly and it's such a dire situation.
Well, Alicia Clark also told us, though, that relief organizations have expertise in getting medications to disaster areas, say, after a hurricane, wildfire, or tornado.
We're used to seeing things like power outages where refrigerators go down. We're used to seeing, you know, road closures, just an interruption in the transportation lanes. It's better and easier to handle those deviations when there's already a protocol in place. And so we can kind of think of COVID as being this global scale disaster, in a sense, affecting so many. And so with all of these uncertainties, I think that being able to be flexible, it would be really helpful to maintaining the product. And so it comes down to having a well-defined plan and really having that communication in place and coordination among all the groups that are involved.
That was Alicia Clark. She's a pharmacist overseeing cold chain distribution with the humanitarian organization Direct Relief. Now, Dr. Schaffner, Alicia said a lot of really interesting things there, and I wanted to get your thoughts on a couple of them. First of all, she talked about the importance of data, and I presume not just data in tracking the actual vaccine, but then in its final distribution to people.
Yes, that's very, very important. The CDC will have in place a system to evaluate constantly the effectiveness of the vaccine and its safety in an ongoing way. The average person doesn't know that we constantly monitor the safety of all the vaccines that we use on a routine basis in children and adults. Of course, the job here, as we have been saying, is larger, but it's also very insistent because these are new vaccines, and so they've been studied very carefully in these trials, but not when we give it to hundreds of thousands and indeed millions of people. But the CDC, the Food and Drug Administration, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, and others have systems in place that are quite cooperative in monitoring in a constant fashion. And for that, you have to have good data. And so the individual state vaccine registries, the vaccine information systems will be very, very critical. We'll have to know who received which vaccine and when in order to make these assessments with precision.
Well, we've got actually some interesting questions coming in from On Point listeners, because I've said a couple of times during this hour the initial data showing 95% effectiveness for both Moderna and Pfizer's vaccines. So Jeff Stone is saying, when you say 95% effective, Jeff wonders, effective against what? Aren't there multiple strains of COVID-19 and isn't it mutating, Dr. Schaffner?
Actually, the virus has been in its essential piece, the piece that the vaccine works against, the so-called spike protein, has been remarkably stable. Of course, the virus mutates a little bit, as we might say, around the edges, so we can see which strain arrived from Europe and which strain arrived from China. We can make those distinctions. But the essential part of the virus, that spike protein against which these vaccines work, has remained stable. So far, so good.
And another Jeff Kirstein says, since people appear to be able to become reinfected with COVID, will we need to continue developing additional vaccines? Will this end up like the flu and is just always with us, Dr. Schaffner?
Well, there have been repeat infections documented. So far, they're pretty unusual. So we'll have to see how long protection lasts, both from the real disease and from the vaccine. It's possible with a lot of vaccines, we have to get booster doses periodically. But that's down the road. Let's get the vaccine into people. Let's control this outbreak on the front end. And then our studies will tell us, stay tuned, how often we have to come back for repeat vaccination, if we do.
Yeah. So let's summit that first mountain, essentially, is what you're saying. We also received this question, and Professor Swan, I'm going to turn this one to you, but a listener called us and was wondering about the shelf life of vaccines.
Hey, this is Lou Fran from Seattle, Washington. My question is about the Pfizer vaccine. I understand that it only has a 5-day lifespan. So how usable would a vaccine that can only last 5 days be in terms of rolling it out to a state? If it got to a state on day number 2, perhaps after manufacturing, how could you get it to every corner of the state?
Professor Swan, how would you answer that?
Yes. So the 5 days is after the vaccine is thawed. It's at refrigerator temperature. So you have at least 10 days before that. So I'm anticipating 10 days in the thermal shipper, another 5 days after it's thawed. And if you do have any sub-80 freezers, that would also give you additional time because you could put the vaccine in that and keep it longer.
Okay. So in talking about the various pieces of this logistical puzzle, clearly its complexity is evident. So I wonder, Professor Swan, what we haven't discussed yet is there a role for organizations that have really profound logistical expertise? For example, the United States military. I mean, what role would you have the government play in a vaccine distribution program for COVID?
That's a great question. And there has been, various points where you see the military mentioned sometimes in Operation Warp Speed materials. It is not built into the plans from what I can tell. I think the most likely role would really be if there is security needed, that National Guards could provide it. But one thing is that some communities may not feel as comfortable with the vaccine if the military were coming in and delivering it. And we do have lots of other kinds of organizations. There's a rich logistics background with UPS, for example, FedEx. McKesson Distribution Center is playing a role. So I think what we're going to see is that there are going to be a lot of private partners, commercial supply chains are another great example. Something like a CVS or Walgreens are going to be delivering vaccine to nursing homes and long-term care, and they could also play a role in helping get the vaccine out to rural areas. So I think that's where we'll really see a lot of partnerships, as well as with some of the technology companies.
Dr. Schaffner, do you want to jump in there on that?
I would agree completely with Professor Swan. I think the military might be able to help us if we have to set up special facilities, tents, for example, in order to handle large numbers of personnel, and also a bit, as she says, on the security side. But the private sector and the United States government are used to transporting and supplying large amounts of vaccine on a sustained fashion. And those relationships have been well established. They're in place to deliver these COVID vaccines now. I have great confidence that the delivery system is going to work.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. So let's go back upstream here for just a second here, because that good news that we opened the show with about the 95% effectiveness still doesn't yet mean, though, that any vaccine has received formal FDA approval. However, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the government's top infectious disease expert, he in an online event yesterday, describes what the next steps will be that the scientific community is taking or would need to take to get vaccines approved.
What really is happening is this independent process that is looked at by people with no skin in the game, financially or otherwise. I see the data. I get reported the data to me. The FDA sees the data. Soon it will be published where the entire community will see the data.
So, Dr. Schaffner, talk about this a little bit, because as we touched on a little earlier in the show, sadly, there is there's been a significant drop in Americans' trust in their governmental and regulatory institutions. And I have seen lots of people say, well, I'm not going to believe it when the FDA approves this vaccine, because it either happened too fast or it happened under this administration, or I don't believe vaccines, whatever. So, I mean, what would you tell people about should they have faith in the regulatory and approval process around this vaccine? And if so, why?
The short answer is yes, definitely, as a matter of fact. What's really quite clear is that there are going to be two external advisory committees who have, as Dr. Fauci said, no skin in the game. Excuse me. They're tough people who will evaluate these data. One external advisory group advises the Food and Drug Administration, and the other external advisory group advises the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC. And both of those will express their opinions very clearly about, first, whether the vaccine should indeed receive the emergency use authorization, if it's safe and effective enough. And then the CDC advisory committee will direct the prioritization scheme and who should receive the vaccine and when. Both of those systems have been in place for many, many years. They work routinely. They are very rigorous, and they can provide great confidence and reassurance to the American public that the vaccine will be safe and effective. And then, of course, we have to transmit that information, including, and I would like to mention this very quickly, to subpopulations such as our African-American community, Hispanic community, and other ethnic minorities, because surveys have already shown that among the reluctant people, reluctance is deep in those communities. And that's a paradox, of course, because they are communities disproportionately affected by COVID. So we want to make sure that they have the information and the reassurance so that they can make wise decisions.
And Professor Swan, we've only got about 30 seconds left here, but let's keep our eye on the future. And I want one last bit of mining of your expertise here. As we get into the distribution phase of a COVID-19 vaccine, where would you look in particular to get a sense as to whether the system is working?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the system is working, but certainly in terms of preventing cases, the disease hotspots, in terms of the distribution systems themselves, we'll look at the lead time and all of the data on how many people are getting, getting the shot in the arm and how quickly it's happening. And we will start seeing that data.
And you know what? It is absolutely a professor of systems engineering who would ask me, what part of the system are you talking about? you're exactly right to ask that. But we're out of time for today. Professor Julie Swan, Professor of Industrial and Systems Engineering at North Carolina State University, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Dr. William Schaffner, professor of preventative medicine, infectious disease and immunization policy at Vanderbilt. Dr. Schaffner, thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.